Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
Needs to have that trailing hook. I really like that. It needs to push water to let its presence be known to the fish. And so a fairly decent head on it, something that pushes water. Has to have fine dark markings. And then it also has to have movement. Has to have movement and as many types of movement as you can. And so, for instance, like to get both barring and movement into the fly.
That was Tim Flagler on the four things every swung fly must have. Trout Spay, finding fish, and quite possibly the greatest fly tying YouTuber on the planet. Today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
We are still looking for a few spots to fill the Stillwater School. It's open right now. If you go to wetflyswing.com/trips, T-R-I-P-S, you can learn more and find out what we have going there and get a shot at heading up to the Northern Lights Lodge for some Stillwater goodness with Phil Roy. Today's episode is sponsored by Dalton at Country Financial, who thrives on helping families and community members through the power of education and proper insurance coverage. The unexpected will happen, so it's always best to make sure your assets and life are protected. You can check out Dalton right now at wetflyswing.com/country and make sure you are protected today. Today's episode is sponsored by Maverick Fly Fishing. They make the lightest Euro nymphing reel in the world, which makes your rod more sensitive, casting more accurate, and you can hold your dead drifts longer without shoulder burn. Check out Maverick Fly Fishing Stinger and their other Euro nymph products and support this podcast by heading over to wetflyswing.com/maverick right now. That's Maverick, M-A-V-R-K, wetflyswing.com/maverick. Check out the lightest and most unique Euro nymphing reel right now. Tim Flagler is back on the show to break out some of his magic with a focus around trout spay. We find out which lines and which rods are best, how he presents the fly, and the location where he presents that fly to fish. And of course, we talk about fly tying and some of his top flies. Like I said earlier, it doesn't get much bigger than this. Trout spay, Tim Flagler, tightlinesproduction.com. Here we go. How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing really well, Dave. A little busy, a little haggard with show season, but other than that, not too bad.
I love it. Yeah, I haven't been out as much as last year. I feel like I'm getting a break a little bit. I mean, I love the shows too, but remind us again, I know you're doing all the show circuits. What's your favorite thing about the show scene?
A lot of it is just meeting old friends. I got to be completely honest, both industry people as well as people that, you know, who just stop by and say hello and, you know, people that watch my YouTube channel, and it's just nice to get to meet them in person, you know, correspond online and everything like that. But to see them in person and chat with them, and especially people that, you know, I've met at the shows year after year, and it's really cool to get to interact with them in person.
Yeah. And at this point, you probably know, I mean, you've been doing this a while. Do you feel like you kind of know everybody out there, or there are still a lot of new faces?
It's still new faces, but it's, this is going to sound terrible. I'm not getting any younger, and it's so many faces, and I'm pretty good at recognizing faces, you know, and names, I've got to admit, a little dodgy on the names. And then we have some people that do crossover between different shows. And so, like, you know, I know them from Denver, Pleasanton, California, and they show up at the Atlanta show. It just really confuses me sometimes. Like, what? I thought, you know, that kind of deal.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all good, and they're all very good about it. It's not like they're upset that I can't come up with a name or anything.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. So you got a couple more. We're kind of coming in here in February, so you got a couple more shows right there on the West Coast.
Yeah, well, and then back east. So I'm going to be doing Denver and then Pleasanton, California. And then we're back here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is always a fun show, kind of the close of the, you know, the big fly fishing shows, the Ferimskis. And then we do one more in north of Detroit, the Midwest show, which is a great, really nice show for me to round out the season on. And a lot of good people and a lot of variety at that show. You know, you're kind of getting traveling saltwater guys, Great Lakes guys, you know, driftless guys, and some steelheaders in there as well. So some two-handed stuff. And yeah, I like the variety at the shows.
Remind us again, where are you at? Where do you guys live?
We're in northwestern New Jersey, kind of out in the middle of nowhere in New Jersey, and have a beautiful trout stream that flows right through the center of town, the south branch of the Raritan River. And in fact, that's actually fishing pretty well right now.
Yeah, I heard it's been pretty mild winter so far. Is that the case out in New Jersey?
Yeah, we had one real big cold snap last week. Fortunately, Joan and I were down in Atlanta, so we missed it. But yeah, single digits, and then it bounced right back up, and ice is out of the rivers, and actually the trout spay bite afternoon has just been fabulous, as well as some midge hatches, you know, sporadic midge hatches throughout the day. We're very lucky here where I'm in New Jersey. We can pretty much fish year round. The only months that get a little dodgy are summertime when it just gets too warm, and so we stop fishing, but the trout do hold over, so it's good.
Yeah, we were up there in December, and it was a pretty mild trip. We hit Ohio for steelhead with Jeff Liskay, and it was a really cool experience.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, I hadn't been fished that whole Lake Erie. It was really amazing. So we're excited to get back. We're even thinking like maybe we'll do like a tour of a few states, maybe start in New York and kind of work our way across, something like that.
Oh, yeah, you could work your way around from like Salmon River on Ontario, and then go all the way around through the Rochester stuff and over to Buffalo, and then... Wow, that would be a great trip, Dave.
Yeah, that's what we're working on. So we'll see how it comes together. It's one of those things, you know, you have limited time, but it is a good part of the country. So so I just look in here, it was episode 279. We're in the 400s now, and we're doing a lot of more contests. It was only a year ago that we chatted. It seems like since it was back in 279, that was a long time ago, but we've done quite a few episodes since then. So,
jeez, yeah, you've been busy.
This is going to be awesome. This is going to be awesome to catch up with you, because we're going to talk trout spay today. I mean, you obviously, I think, made your name. You know, everybody knows you for sure from Tightlines Productions, all the fly tying you've done. We talked about that in the last episode. Today we're going to dig into trout spay, which is another challenge for some people, a lot of people, really, because I think even to the definition, sometimes you say trout spay and people are like, well, you know, what do you mean exactly? What is trout spay? So maybe we could start there, like, because I know you have a program where you cover this. Let's just walk people through this. Like, start just on trout spay. Is there like a definition, or is it pretty broad?
It's pretty broad. And what it really refers to are lightweight spay rods. Rods that pretty much weren't in existence until about 15 years ago. I mean, you had larger, say 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 weight spay rods that were used for Atlantic salmon or steelhead, you know, larger species, larger rivers. And then what people began to figure out was that you could just downsize that gear a little bit, apply the same casting techniques, and just make the gear more suitable for trout. So I think there may be a one weight trout spay out there. I'm not, don't hold me to that, but I know because I have one. They're a bunch of 2, 3, 4 weight. And I think you can consider trout spay gear going up to about a 5 weight. And it's a little misleading because those rods are, they say you can actually add 3 line weights to them. So a 2 weight is effectively a 5 weight, you know, in a normal overhead, say 9-foot 5 weight rod, overhead casting rod. And so it can handle, you know, a fairly large fish, even on a 2 weight. You get up to a 5 weight, you know, akin to an 8 weight, you know, normal overhead casting weight forward fly line rod. And, you know, rods range anywhere from really as short as about 10 feet, you know, all the way up to 13.6, I guess, would be about the biggest trout spey rod I've heard of. And it's super fun stuff. It really is. And I actually see in the coming years, maybe things like one weight and zero weight trout spey rods, you know, kind of teeny, but still with line setups, whether they're Skagit heads or Scandi heads that allow you to do these spey type casts and just on smaller and smaller water.
Right. And with trout spey, do you think most people think of, you know, when you hear trout spey, because you could kind of say like single hand spey too, but is it more synonymous with like two-handed rods or is it kind of overlap?
There's kind of an overlap there. And the way I got into it, it's really kind of a backwards way, but it does involve the single hand spey. I mean, a lot of people I think might go to get into spey in general, they might say take a trip to Alaska or to the Canadian Maritimes. And, you know, the guide there is using a two-handed rod, say a, you know, a seven weight or an eight weight, you know, something around 13.6. And so they try it out and they go, wow, that's pretty cool. They get home to their local waters and go, hey, there's this, you know, they hear about this new thing, trout spey, and get into it that way. For me, I was really trying to solve one problem and one problem only, and it was night fishing. And we got some great night fishing here in New Jersey. And if you're ever going to have problems night fishing, it's going to be on your back cast. If you're overhead casting and, you know, a lot of times where I am, the trout want to get out of the deep water and get into the shallower water to feed at night. And if you're wading out in the river to get your back cast clear of, you know, whether it's a steep hillside or overhanging trees, that's not good because, first of all, you're wading in the river in the middle of the night. Secondly, you're spooking trout that want to be there. So I don't know whether it was a mistake or I went to the OPST, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics website, and started watching some of their videos on YouTube. And gosh, if you don't have a second mortgage application, don't go to that site because it's such a deep, dark, wonderful hole. And so I just started. I got one of their commando heads, put it on my regular 9 foot five weight rod, you know, that I normally drive fly fish and nymph with and everything. I got a spare spool and just changed it out. And I could fire cast all the way across all the water here in New Jersey with no problem at all and no back cast, and started adding different tips to that head. You can go anywhere from floating to intermediate to, you know, 3 inches per second, 5, 7 inches per second, and then into, you know, the T10 and T14 and all these, you know, things that are really going to get it down deep. But they say once you start doing that, it's called being spay curious.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then you watch a few more videos and they're guys casting these two-handed rods and you just go, wow, those casts look even cooler with a two-handed rod than they do when you're doing it single-handed. And it's almost a given. Seriously, if you take up the single-hand trout spay stuff, I don't know how you would avoid in the future not getting a two-handed rod. It's super, super fun. And the fact of the matter is the casting, even the single-hand stuff, really, it changed my approach to overhead casting as well. I'm using some of those spey techniques, sort of spey casts when I'm just regular fishing, you know, with a weight forward line and on my, say my 9 foot five weight, and something like a snap T enables you to relocate your cast back upstream. If you're say streamer fishing, just with a single move, as opposed to doing that overhead casting kind of lawn sprinkler deal where you're working your way upstream. And it's a very, very quick and efficient way to get back upstream. So yeah, I came to trout spey very, very differently than most people would. And I'm glad I did. There's a lot of different things you can do fly fishing aside from just say the normal overhead casting five and four weight rods. You know, there's Euro nymphing and there's Tenkara. And this is another one that is especially fun. And, you know, there's so much to do with it. Not just trout spey, kind of gets you into, I started using spey gear in the surf here on the Jersey Shore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so you bump up there and you figure out, well, you know, I got that that 3 or 4 weight trout spay, but man, a 7 weight switch rod would be about perfect for the surf. And then you do that, and then you start looking at,
You got it all covered.
Yeah.
You're probably on the, and then you turn around, you've got like as many spay rods as you have single hand rods. Is that kind of how it looks?
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of, as for the fly fishing industry as a whole, I look at it as a wonderful thing for my saving for retirement. It's not such a great thing, but
no,
it sure is fun.
Well, I mean, I look at it too the same. I mean, I joke about that, but it's true. I mean, a lot of the stuff I do is spay now because I definitely do a lot of steelhead, you know, and that's good. But then, yeah, you hear about these people. We've done episodes with people casting off the back of their pickups off into the salt,
yeah,
you know, with their spay rods doing like full overhand casts. So you don't even have to have necessarily doing the snap T stuff. There's all sorts of different ways to do it, right?
And for me anyway, I'm north of 60 now, and my shoulder from years of chucking a 9 or 10 weight 9 foot rod are just it's brutal on the arm. And the a 7 weight kind of switch rod, 11 and a half feet or so, you can do the waterborne casts. You can go Scandi or Skagit, and if I get up on a jetty or breakwater or even a dock, you can also do overhead, which is a really, you know, with say a Skagit head, you can absolutely chuck a fly line.
Two hands.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. So much more leverage than you have just with a single hand.
And it wouldn't be as hard. I wonder, could you do that? Like if you're out, you know, just on the boat, like going for like a bonefish, do you think you could kind of use the two-handed thing there?
I don't know. I get asked that a lot, and I've thought about it a lot. I'm not sure that it would be as effective as that, you know,
being
that
quick. You got to be 7 seconds, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you're dealing with some shooting line in a big head, and to get it out quick, I don't think it's really viable for that. If it was, I'm pretty sure a whole bunch of people would already be doing it. And again, it's kind of a deep, dark hole, but it's great. There's a lot there. And I joke about it when I do my trout spay presentations. Sometimes I'll go down in the evening to practice my cast, and you know, the trout keep hooking and interrupting my casting practice, which, you know, when you hook a 16-inch trout, you get in it as quickly as you can to get it off so you can go back to
the practice. Well, that's
practice.
What they say.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's why steelheading gets so good, right? We kind of joke about that too, but it's not always, steelheading can be tough. So sometimes you're practicing, right?
Yeah.
But they say you should never try to fish and practice. Like take your time to practice. And then when you're fishing, fish, right? But don't
fish. Yeah.
So it's different.
Yeah.
But you said, so trout spay presentation, I like that where you're going because you can have a presentation. Maybe you can break down your presentation here a little bit so we can get a feel for what you cover there.
Sure, sure. But I start all of them off really with where, it seems a little weird, but where trout are most of their lives. And that's within a foot of the bottom. I shoot a whole ton of underwater footage of trout, which doesn't appear on my YouTube channel. I kind of save it for presentations and seminars and the like. But they're so consistently within a foot of the bottom, except, you know, there are times when they're feeding higher in the water column, mostly in the warmer months and when you got bugs coming off. But, you know, they're down there. They're away from their major predators, most of them birds. It's where the large majority of their food comes from, you know, a stonefly nymph washing off a rock or caddis larva or even, you know, things like fish eggs, you know, spawn. It doesn't go up in the water column, it stays down there. And the other thing is it's easier for them to swim down there. There's generally a current cushion that's not moving so fast. So kind of start off there and go, a weird place to start for spay, but with the trout spay, it's very easy to get flies down to the correct depth, where those fish are, where you're not getting constantly hung up on the bottom, because it's very easy to add either weighted tips or say versaliters or polyliters to your spay rig. And particularly with the two-handed rods, but you absolutely with a single hand spay, you can do it. It's just far easier to cast those heavier tips and polyliters with spay style casts as opposed to overhead casts.
Yeah.
And so you get the depth that way. You know, most of the time when we're doing this, not all the time, We're imitating bait fish or even crayfish when we're doing trout spay. There are times, and I can talk about that, when we're imitating insects. But those things, in fact, insects and say bait fish, dace, darter, sculpins, they're neutrally buoyant, you know, and they as soon as you put weight in a fly, it doesn't behave in a neutrally buoyant manner. Okay. So I really like, I fish weighted flies with, bead heads, cone heads, lead free wire wraps behind those. I do fish them and do cast them when I'm trout spay fishing, but I would always prefer to have a weightless fly taken down to depth where those trout are. By say a poly leader or, you know, a sink tip. I think the whole thing behaves more naturally that way. That's how I start off the presentation. First of all, showing where the trout are most of the time, and then talking about the different setups that you can use. And I go through a single hand setup, you know, how you'd set up your regular 9 foot five weight. And then I go into how you'd maybe, kind of use that same rig, but like on a four weight two-handed trout spay. Those two are kind of skagit rigs and shorter heads designed for generally larger flies and heavier sink tips. And then the final one to me, which is what I do mostly here in New Jersey, is a very light, you know, like a three weight trout spay rod, kind of a switch rod, about, 11 and a half feet long with a Scandi head on it. So kind of a more delicate approach, and not as big and heavy as a skagit head, more designed for a subtle presentation and smaller flies in not all that deep water. Now here, a deep water here is considered a six feet is real deep for New Jersey. And a lot of times it's not fast water in that 6 feet. So we just don't need big sink tips. And most of our bait fish species here are fairly small, the dace and the darters. And so flies are smaller and can be lighter. And that rig with the Scandi head on it and, a lighter poly leader, say an intermediate or a 3 inch per second, really gets you down to where the fish are, but you can present much, much smaller flies very naturally. And that's where there are a lot of insect species that are actually very good swimmers. And so we can imitate them. Plus we can also imitate emerging insects, with traditional small flies and think like North Country spiders and wet flies and soft hackles, that's my really fun stuff right now. That's where I just have the most fun. And it's actually changed kind of my fly tying. And I'm looking back, in the history, if you will, in looking back at those older flies that people fished and that they fished, in kind of a daisy chain of two, three, even four flies, a brace of flies, if you will. And with a light Scandi setup, oh my gosh, is that fun? Just chucking three flies kind of down and across, maybe a little upstream mend. And it's so light and delicate, even in small water, you're not spooking a lot of fish. And the real thing is, and I think anybody who has done either single hand or two handed trout spay will attest to, it's you're just swinging and waiting for a grab. You can put the rod down at your hip and look around. You're not staring at a little ball of plastic or a bright piece of monofilament all day. There's times for that, to do that. And, if you really want to catch numbers of fish, that's the way to go. I can't tell you that this trout spay stuff is going to get huge numbers of fish, because it generally doesn't, but it's so much more relaxing and just, for me, enjoyable.
That's right. No, I hear you. I feel the same way. Yeah, it's kind of like that meditative thing. So you mentioned the 9 foot five weight. So walk us through a setup. What would that be? So a lot of people probably have a 9 foot five weight. Do they have to go out and get a specific type of skagit or Scandi line for that? What would you recommend?
Well, what I recommend for the 9 foot five weight is I would recommend a short skagit head, something like OPST kind of started it off with their Commando head series, which are like, most of them are like 13 and a half feet long. And very, very heavy. And behind that Skagit head is some type of shooting line. It can be like a bare monofilament, like OPST's laser line. You could use something like Amnesia that doesn't have a lot of memory to it, doesn't get all kinked up. And that really helps with shooting line. And then off that Skagit head, to complete a Skagit setup, you need at least a poly leader, preferably a tip, to complete that line. And then from that tip, they can be anywhere from 5 to 12 feet in length. You just run straight tippet off of that, you know, 1, 2, 3x tippet off of that. I usually go fluorocarbon for that, and then right to the fly.
Yeah.
And so the way I look at it, Dave, is with a rig like that, and you're doing these, you know, waterborne casts mostly with a Skagit rig. You can do touch and go casts, but mostly waterborne casts. And you can also add a haul to it because, you know, you say, like me, you have your right hand on the grip and I have my left hand on the line. And so at different places during that cast, say a snap T, I can add a little haul in there to energize the whole thing, bend the rod more, and really put some power into the cast. So super fun to cast with that stuff.
Yeah, that is fun.
Yeah. And you generally need to have a spare spool in order to do that. So if you have, you know, your regular reel with a weight forward line and get a spare spool for that, you really can't change out heads with that setup, if you know what I mean. You can't put it on the end of your weight, a head like that on the end.
Weight forward line or something.
Right, right. And to peel off all that weight forward line, you know, 90 feet or whatever, it's just not practical. So a spare spool really, really helps out to do that. And you just, you know, if you can be, say, dry fly fishing and, you know, throughout the morning, maybe switch over to nymphing with your weight forward line, and then a little later in the afternoon, maybe just change that spool out, put on a Skagit head. And other companies other than OPST make them. Virtually every company makes them now. And they're I have a couple different from Airflow and from Rio, and all of them work very well. They, you know, range in size from 13.5 up to like 22 feet for those Skagit heads, and super fun to cast.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, they have a bunch. We were up and we were fishing with Jeff in Ohio. We were using like some of the SA's stuff, and it was, I think we had a new line, but it's the same exact thing. I mean, essentially, it's what you're talking about, just a little heavier for steelhead. Now, the grain weight is a little bit of confusion there, right? Because the space stuff is kind of measured by grain weight, and then the normal single hand lines is kind of 5 weight, 6 weight, whatever. How do you pick like the OPST? Is it by grain weight now with the single hand line, or how do you know which line to get? Let's say you have that 5 weight.
Yeah, and this is what turns a lot of people off. And you know, we're into different weights, and it's confusing because the weight of a trout spay line isn't like the weight of a, you know, a normal weight forward line. And so many of the websites, whether they're rod manufacturers or the line manufacturers, have charts that you can go by that, you know, if you have, say, I don't know, a Douglas Sky G 5 weight, and it will tell you, it'll give you a grain window generally for that rod. And, you know, so anywhere from say 200 to 250 grains for that.
Yeah. So even on the single hand of rods, there will be a grain weight window you can find.
Right. And there's differences between the Skagit and the Scandi, and it gets crazy so fast. The best recommendation I can give to anybody out there who's considering this is to go through a shop, go through people that know. I mean, at a fly shop, you know, they have people in all the time that are giving them feedback. They're out there casting this gear, and you can save yourself so much time and money by going to somebody. Listen, I've got this 9-foot 5-weight Scott Radian, let's say, and what would you recommend? And lines are different. You know, a Rio shooting head is not going to be exactly the same as an OPST. You know, it might be a little bit longer. It might be. And so what setups work well? Because there are two things at play here. You can burn a whole lot of money trying to get something that works with the rod that you have. And secondly, if you're just learning it, you can waste a whole lot of time trying to learn how to do these casts, and it may not be you. It might be that your setup isn't correct. And you could think, oh, geez, I'm never going to learn this. I'm not getting tight loops. I'm not really getting my line out there the way I want to.
Yep.
It could be you, but
yeah.
And it also could be what you have as a setup. And so ideally go through the shop, and even better yet, have some a spay instructor go through and kind of go, okay, your gear's fine. It's that you're moving too fast, or you're just putting power on at the wrong spot. That's the ideal thing to do, is to have one-on-one, or go to one of the, Spay Nation or a Spay Clave somewhere and get the instruction that way. Really, really helps out. Yeah.
Today's episode is sponsored by Chode Outdoor, legendary comfort and equipment you can trust. Chode insists on the finest material and craftsmanship to assure you have the highest standards of quality. You'll feel in control of the elements in your Chode gear. Every product is solidly backed with a no-nonsense warranty against defects. And I have a family connection to Chode over the years. Back in the shop, the old shop, my dad carried Chode, and he wore those proudly with confidence. And now I'm carrying on that tradition, supporting Chode. And I'm very excited about the new products coming out this year and working with Chode in 2023. I'm pretty rough in my gear and find myself putting a lot of miles on that gear and being pretty rough on it. So it's good to know that the Chode gear is durable, is bomber, and I don't have to worry about it. And even on those long trips, and if you have a blowout, it's not going to be a good situation. So I'm excited to keep digging into this year. Clean, comfortable, charismatic, and ready for any situation you can throw at it. You can head over right now to Chode Outdoor at wetflyswing.com/Chode. That's Chota, to support this podcast and a great family company right now. Okay, now back to the show. There's probably some spay claves or something out there in your neck of the woods. I know there's some all over the West and Midwest. Do you find that? I mean, I know steelhead's always been the thing, but are you finding now spay claves are more than just steelhead? It's about all these species?
Yeah. I mean, with the pandemic, we really ran into a problem with that, because, just as trout spay seemed to be getting good momentum and kind of spay casting in general, pandemic, and we couldn't get together in large groups, and a lot of that seems to be coming back now. I just got a text that it looks like Spay Nation is coming back to upstate New York.
Oh, there
the Salmon
you go.
River.
Awesome.
And so yeah, and it was, I mean, it was great back in the day, but we just lost a few years there. And I also heard that there's a big one up in Quebec this summer. Unfortunately, I'm going to be away for that. I would love to get up for that. And there's smaller groups that get together and give to group spay casting and trout spay clinics and things like that. And absolutely worth it.
And even like what you're doing, like, right, Tim? I mean, because we're kind of going over something. We won't cover everything in this podcast because it's impossible, but you have your own kind of, probably people can track you down, see where you're going to be presenting next on some of this.
Yes, absolutely. And I do it at the fly fishing shows, whether it's actually casting on the casting pond or just a video presentation to show these different setups. And I usually bring gear for show and tell when I'm doing that. And so they get to see what I'm actually talking about with poly leaders and tips and heads and the difference between them. And I've also done a few clinics on the river, which have just been a ton of fun for me to do.
It's nice to see, because you're known, like we said at the start, you're known for these fly tying, like the way you do your videos are kind of top of the game. But I mean, you're not just doing fly tying. Now you're expanding. Do you feel like the fly tying thing is just one of your things and now you're expanding, or have you always kind of done a little bit of the fly fishing with the fly tying on the teaching end?
Yeah, quite a bit, especially locally. And then, I do presentations on night fishing and now trout spay and what trout like to eat, because I do have one of the things I really enjoy is getting footage of trout underwater and bugs on the water or in the water. And macro videography is kind of my specialty, which comes from the fly tying. And so I also have a lot of video of bugs underwater.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, looking at their coloration and movement and, profile and everything like that, really up close and personal in fish tanks. So that helps with the fly tying. You know, I can pick out things there and incorporate them into my patterns.
But you're not giving up the fly tying. You're still going strong.
No. I'm trying to. It's a little hard to get videos out, you know, during show season. There's just so much. And I think it might surprise people how with the videos that I produce, kind of bare minimum is about 7 or 8 hours of production time.
Oh, wow. Per video? Per one like 10-minute video?
Yeah. And I'm a video producer by trade. I've been doing it for almost 40 years now. And so it's a different kind of production than just, say, sitting down and doing a speed tying thing like you see on Instagram or TikTok.
Those
have a place. I love watching them. They're interesting, but they are different than a really, you know, produced tying video the way we do.
Yeah, I love it. I love your style too, the way you do the videos, you know. I mean, not only is it the front facing, which is a unique thing, but just how you add, you know, you got the different views, but just the feel of it. It's not slow, but it's like, it's nice and calm and you're getting some history. Maybe you're talking about something, right? So it's not just, you bring the whole thing in and it's kind of the way I would love, you know, I think of kind of the way I podcast. I want it to flow like that too, where it's just like, you know, people are just listening, having a conversation, you're learning, but you're also maybe digging into some history. Is that, I mean, when you put together your initial fly tying videos, you know, is what we're seeing now kind of what you thought at the beginning, or has it evolved over the years?
It's kind of like from the beginning. When I decided that I wanted to do it as a video producer, I and a fly tire, kind of a combination of the two, I had some criteria that, and I can go through it. One is it had to be from the tire's perspective. And, you know, I guess I might have a little right-left dyslexia, because when I look at it facing toward the tire, the camera view, I get a little mixed up as to what's going on. So I figured give the viewer that view. Secondly, it really bothered me from early tying videos that I saw that there wasn't materials prep. And to me, materials prep is just as important as tying it onto the hook. And, you know, whether it's keeping the tips on pheasant tail fibers aligned, or, you know, how do you strip a hackle feather? And so that was another big part of it. I insist if I was going to do these tying videos, I had to have that. The other thing is many of them, you know, are recorded live as somebody's tying. And as a video editor, that's really problematic. And so it doesn't allow for editing to get rid of dead air or mess ups or, you know, whatever it is. And so all the narration for mine is written and then recorded, and then cut up and, you know, goes with the video. So a different difference from a lot. And yeah, again, something that I insisted on. And then, of course, you know, filling the frame with the fly. I never saw any reason to, you know, have a whole ton of space around the fly. You need to see it.
The closer the better, right? Like zoom in as far as you can, yeah.
The only problem with that is, though, Dave, is that, you know, you're seeing things that even if you have magnification,
you wouldn't see.
You wouldn't see. And
right.
So I had one the other day, and it's just one of those, I really had to laugh about it. And I tied a size 24 parachute called a high vis midge. And one of the comments on it was, you know, great tying video, Tim, but in the end, the fly does look a little sloppy.
Yeah.
he wasn't joking. And, you know, and if you're looking at a size 24 on a 65-inch television, you know, that it's 2 feet across, but in reality, when you look at it, it's, you know, about an eighth of an inch. And so it's a little deceiving at times for people.
That is cool though. But that is the whole thing. That's the package that separates you from, I think, most everybody else, is that you've been producing that sort of quality for a while. And yeah, it's good. And you know, you've got the connections, right? Like Orvis, that's still a big, I mean, how was that? How did that, I'm sure you talked about that in the last one, but you're still affiliated with Orvis, right? Doing some great stuff there.
Yeah. And it started a long time ago, gosh, probably 12 years ago now. And MidCurrent's the same way with Marshall Cutchin at MidCurrent. They have, both Orvis and MidCurrent have been posting our videos for years. I mean, a full decade. And, it, you know, as soon as the video comes out, it goes up on both their, the Orvis Fly Fishing blog comes out in the MidCurrent newsletter, goes up on their website. So they both have been incredible for us in terms of exposure. And then with Orbis, we've done some stuff doing, this was actually Tom Rosenbauer's idea way back when, 1 minute tying tips, which have been extremely popular. I think we're just over 200 now, and it's just one little, you know, technique, and you get through it in a minute. Doesn't require sitting down for, you know, a full 7 or 8 minutes to go through a whole tying video. And to me, those tips like that they're very digestible, if you will. And yeah, you tend to remember them better if they're just that one little thing. And then, I don't know whether you've seen them, but, Tom Rosenbauer and I do these tie-offs on the first Monday of every month, which we started doing it as a pandemic thing. But just because you couldn't get together, you couldn't do, you know, no fly fishing shows, and they have become really popular, and they're a ton of fun to do. And Tom and I do a little chirping back and forth. And to me, it's so cool that, you know, we've both been tying for a very long time, and we'll take a pattern, the same pattern, basically the same materials. We tie in entirely different ways, and result is almost exactly the same. So it really shows that there's just like no way that a fly has to be tied.
No. And that's the beauty of it, right? Is that the flies that are tweaked even a little bit, you know, might make the difference on your specific water, right? If you customize it.
And it also has to do with, you know, where you are in terms of tying experience, what materials you have, and then just overall preference, you know, what level of dexterity do you have?
Exactly. Eyesight, right? Eyesight's a big one.
Yeah, certainly. And so I hope it suggests to people that they can do it how it's comfortable for them, and that there's nothing that's against the law.
I always wonder about that, because that's what I appreciate about watching your videos, that you're really good with, you know, not only, I mean, the dry flies, like the really meticulous, like that's one of my struggles. I mean, I'm not like a bad person, right? Because I've never enjoyed the dry flies. I've never really nailed it. You know, I've tied some, but it's just one of those things. I think I realized, you know what? I don't enjoy doing the dry flies, so I'm not going to tie them. And, you know, it doesn't make me a bad person, because that's the way I am. But you've nailed that, right? I mean, that's something you're good at. Have you always been really good at the kind of cat skill stuff and all that small stuff?
Well, I'm the first one to admit, like with Catskill stuff, as compared to some, I'm a rank beginner. I mean, just because of where I live here, and the people that have influenced me have all been Catskill style tires. But there are people, I mean, some right in the town that I live in that are incredible at it. It's like their area of study. Let's equate it to science. I study biology. Those guys, you know, study macroinvertebrate insects.
Yeah, they're much higher, right?
Yeah, and so the quality of their work it's exceptional. And to me, things like Instagram are so great for showing off that quality, and you just go, their flies are just so elegant and perfect. And they're also, you know, you don't have to do this, but they're guys that are tying historically accurate stuff. And this doesn't apply just to Catskill style flies. It might be, you know, the Kerry Stevens flies from up in Rangeley Lakes area of Maine, or flat wings, you know, for saltwater. And they're using the materials that were used, you know, back when the flies were invented, or, you know, they're staying very true to some techniques that were used during that time period. And so their flies at least harken back to that time. And that's, it's really neat from a historical perspective that they're carrying those traditions through. I'm kind of all over the place.
Right. You cover it all.
Yeah, I cover it all, and I love that stuff. But you know, I like tying parachutes as much as I like tying Catskill style.
Remind us again on the Catskills. What makes it a Catskill style dry fly versus, say, just another type of dry fly?
Dry fly. It's generally that the hackle collar is wound vertically, as opposed to, say, parallel to the water surface, as in a parachute fly.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So it's a broad category. So when you think of dry flies, like your traditional whatever fly, blue-winged olive, or you know, whatever dry fly, if it's tied vertically, then that's pretty much a Catskill style.
That has become the meaning of Catskill style flies. But if you're tying true Catskill style flies, there are quite a few other things that come into play. Probably the biggest one is that the fly sets off the water and uses the tail, the tip of the tail, to cause surface tension. Also, the bottom of the hook bend, that little place where the very bottom of the hook bend contacts the water surface, that should be another point of surface tension to hold the fly up. And then the hackle points are the other points of surface content. So the bug rides up with kind of tilted up in the front, the way an adult mayfly would. And so the abdomen is actually held off the water and really presents this incredibly realistic view for the trout. They're delicate. And if you're really sticking to Catskill style flies, you're going to leave some space behind the hook eye, some bare shank behind the hook eye, because back in the day they used a turtle knot to tie their tippet onto the fly. And then you throw in some beautiful, say, split wood duck flank wings, and they're just gorgeous.
Yeah, they are gorgeous.
they really are. And you know, a parachute is a very, very effective fly. There's no doubt about it. But they just aren't as elegant as those true Catskill style flies.
Yeah, it is impressive. Nice. So this is good. I'm glad we went down the fly tying track a little bit. We didn't want to leave that.
Yeah, sorry. We got a little far away from trout spay.
But, let's circle back around, because we were talking about you talked about the 9 foot, and I wanted to get in the setup because that is, I think, a point of confusion. So you talked about that. There's a bunch of different types. You know, the OPST has some stuff. You can get your grain weight even balanced with your single. If we take it to two hand, it sounds like 11 and a half foot is something you use. Is it the same thing there? Is the setup the same? Like you're saying, it's still a Skagit head with a tippet. And are you going to set it up similar to how you set up the single hand rod?
Yeah, in a way. And with a Skagit head, and again, Skagit generally shorter than a Scandi head, and intended for bigger flies, bigger water, and heavier sink tips. Scandi lighter, generally longer, yeah, and lighter stuff.
What's the cutoff there? I know this is probably hard, but if you had to cut off, say, okay, I've got this Skagit, which is like the garden hose, big, heavy thing, you turn over big squirmers, yeah, and then you need heavy sinking lines, but what is the cutoff? When would you go to the Scandi? When do you know? Is it like, is there a certain sink tip you wouldn't cast the Skagit with or something like that?
Gosh, that's a tough one. And now there is, there's kind of a merging, if you will, you know, their heads that are halfway between a Skagit and a Scandi, and they can handle tips, and they can also handle poly leaders. And generally poly leaders go with Scandis, poly inversa leaders, and tips go with Skagit. But they have, I think every manufacturer is making them now, these kind of hybrids between Skagit and Scandi, which you can sort of do both with. But, you know, everything is in fly fishing is a compromise. And so those, you know, they have drawback. They don't do either just as well as, say, a Scandi would, you know, do the job, or a true Skagit.
Gotcha. Oh, well, let's take it to this. Let's take it to your setup. So it sounds like you have a 11 and a half foot spay two-handed rod. Is that something?
Yeah.
What is your two-hand rod that you would fish for trout if you're swinging, say, normal stuff out there in your area?
I'm kind of looking at the rod rack right now.
Yeah.
it's grown a little bit, Dave, over the years.
Yeah, what's it look like? Describe that rod rack. Does it have more spay rods or more single-handed rods?
It's, wow. It's about a 50-50 split.
No kidding. There you go. So you're fully into it.
Yeah, we're not going to let Joe know this.
Okay? Right.
It's just between us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am, in terms of the trout spay, I do have a 2, a 3, a 4, and a 5.
Oh, wow. You got the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm working on another 5 weight. And so anyway, and some of them I have a Skagit set up on them. And I have a 10 foot Douglas DXF. Or 10 and a half foot DXF, and it's a 4 weight. I have kind of a Skagit set up on that for a little bit deeper water that we get around here. Maybe, you know, spring runoff, faster water, faster and deeper. And so I want some heavier stuff on that. Then I have a little Orvis Clearwater. I think it's 11-2-3 weight. That was kind of an interesting one. I got it, bought it as a kit, which is another way to get around this whole thing of figuring stuff out. Orvis has tested that 9 ways to Sunday, and they have the reel that balances it. They have the line that's going to work with that particular rod, and packaged all together, it's a really great value. So You have that, and then little two-weight. Again, my rods are all over the place. Two-weight Reddington hydrogen, which you can't get anymore. They're no longer making the hydrogen, but it's just this with a little, like 180 grain Scandi line on it. It's I think 11-foot rod, and in that two-weight category, everything is very, very light in the hand, and it's unbelievable for chucking little soft tackles and wet flies and things like that. Super, super fun. You know, particularly as we get in the warmer months. And yeah, it, you know, each has its own merits. The 5-weight, I have both a Skagit head and a Scandi head for it. I probably should talk about that. There are integrated lines now where the running line is directly connected to the head. And which is interesting. It's nice. There isn't that clunk clunk on a loop to loop connection between the shooting line or the running line, if you will, and the head, which is really very nice. But at the same time, you can't easily change the heads out. And so I'm kind of back to more component, where if I have just running line, standard thin running line or shooting line, I can, with a loop to loop connection.
Yeah. Pop it
on. Yeah, pop off the Skagit head and put on a Scandi head, yeah, and off to the races. And the other thing that I found is that although that clunk clunk going through the guides kind of stinks, at nighttime it's really helpful to tell where you are on the line, so you know that the head is completely out of the rod tip and you're ready to cast. So there are merits to both, and you know, if you have an integrated line and somebody steps on that running line and parts it, you know, with a cleat or whatever, the whole thing shot. Whereas, you know, if it was a component system, you could just replace the shooting line and go from there.
Perfect. So you got, yeah, you have it covered. You got a bunch of the, yeah, it sounds like between 10 and a half foot, 11, you know, yeah. Are there, and you said there are some that get 13 and a half, but for the most part, it seems like the lighter stuff, the smaller, shorter is where you would go with trout spay. I mean, when would you think you would go for, say, a longer 13 and a half foot trout? Is that like bigger water?
A trout spay. Yeah. Bigger water generally, and longer casts. I had the opportunity. I went to Iceland this year, and in that situation, we were fishing for big sea run trout. So a 5 to 6 weight trout spay is kind of ideal. And there I was fishing with an 11-4, and because, you know, you're knee to waist deep in water, it's wide open. It's this huge estuary where we were fishing. And somebody else that I was there with had a 6-weight 13-6, and that extra length, you know, a difference of 2 feet was tremendous in terms of casting for me anyway. I'm not a tall guy, and just that extra bit of height and leverage, and you're adding a good 10 yards to the cast, and with the wind and everything, it was really nice. But then again, you know, navigating trees and bushes and stream banks around here in New Jersey on small rivers, the 13-6 is actually a disadvantage, you know. That way, even something like a 10-6 is real nice and compact and easy to get around with.
Today's episode is sponsored by Stonefly Nets, putting quality before quantity with their handcrafted custom wood landing nets. Charleston, South Carolina native Ethan Eigelhart was bitten by the fly fishing bug in 2014, and shortly thereafter started Stonefly Nets. He now lives in the trout-rich waters of the Ozarks and handcrafts some of the sweetest wooden landing nets you'll see. I've been using these Stonefly Nets for quite a while now, and I'm excited to dig into another year. Ethan builds these nets custom, and you can select from 4 sizes and many different wood options. For Ethan, fly fishing is a memory created from a morning on a beautiful stretch of water casting a 3-weight bamboo rod that his grandmother gave to his father, and then he passed to Ethan. Ethan is helping us create the same types of lasting memories every time we're on the water with these classic custom wood nets. You can head over right now to wetflyswing.com/stonefly to check out your custom net right now. That's wetflyswing.com/stonefly, STONEFLY. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Stonefly. Okay, back to the show. So we have the gear a little bit. We have kind of some setups. We talked about that. Maybe the Scandi is another thing we could dig into. Let's talk flies. You mentioned at the beginning about the types of flies. So what are you doing up there? Maybe give us a list of flies that you might use for trout spay? In your area, are you using the smaller wet flies and some bigger streamers, or how does that look?
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, Dave, to be honest with you. And if you wanted to keep it simple, seriously, just a beadhead woolly bugger is perfect. You know, olive, black, brown, whatever you're used to with that single hand, and you can cast it single hand spay or the two hand, that's perfectly suitable. Again, though, I do like weightless flies, and so a weightless woolly bugger. I have a couple patterns up that that have a pine squirrel back on them, almost like a zonker. So that pine squirrel zonker strip becomes the tail of the fly as well as the back of the fly, and then kind of has a woolly bugger like body to it. So some kind of body around the hook shank, say a chenille, and then hackle pommered over top of that chenille. And I have one that's called the squirrel and hurl bugger, which has been around forever, and a very similar one that I recently posted called an Adams bugger, which incorporates both grizzly and brown saddle hackle. And what I was figuring was, you know, an Adams, size 16 Adams dry fly works so, so well. It's kind of a universal dry fly. And I believe it's because of the mix of brown and grizzly that really, really sets it apart. So incorporated brown and grizzly into this parachute bugger, and it on the swing, you know, it's just been absolutely phenomenal. For the last 8 months or so, and the fly works real well. But I do go bigger. I have some weighted stuff, and you know, again, to me, it's another thing that I can do. And so a lot of you go from spay into trout spay, but it's pulling ideas from you know, intruders used for salmon and steelhead, pulling elements from that, downsizing it, just like we downsize the rods and the rigs. And then, you know, cut shanks, which where you use a shank, or you cut off the bend of a hook and just use the shank. And then you say you have some intruder wire, or maybe some power pro braid that goes back to a smaller hook, trailing hook. And so you get the length, and you get that the business end of the hook way, way back on the fly. Which is good, you know, fix those tail biters. They get a mouthful of iron when they do the tail bite routine. You know, long shanked hooks to me give the fish a real advantage. They're easily pulled out. So if you have a nice small, like size 8 or 10 Gamagatsu octopus trailing way back there, right back at the tail of whatever it is, gosh, it keeps those fish buttoned on there real, real well. And so I'm actually working on a series of flies now to hopefully get into Falling Mill. They carry my flies. You know, they're tied commercially through them, some of my patterns. And it's weighted. It has a cone head. But with these swung flies like that, I like it to have like four things. And it needs to have that trailing hook. I really like that.
Yep.
It needs to push water to let its presence be known to the fish. And so a fairly decent head on it, something that pushes water, has to have fine dark markings, which is kind of, yeah, this comes from looking at bait fish in aquatic macro invertebrates underwater.
Like counter coloration sort of stuff.
Yeah, barring, vermiculations. Right. And so everything living, everything that's protein just about has these fine dark markings in them. And as small as they are, I just absolutely believe that trout recognize it as something living, something protein, and it's something that's of nutritional value. So whether it's I'm imitating a bug or a bait fish, I try to incorporate fine dark markings. So and then it has to have movement and as many types of movement as you can. And so for instance, like to get both barring and movement into the fly, maybe rubber legs, barred rubber legs or silly legs. The other thing is when I watch bait fish underwater in my fish tanks, they're always flashing. Even as dull as, say, a sculpin is, there's a little bit of flash in their scales, some iridescent. So a little flash. So pushes water, fine dark markings, movement, and a little bit of flash.
So five. So that's a bonus one, right? So flash gives you a fifth on the
Yeah, is that a fifth?
I think so. Yeah. We're getting a bonus. So this is going to be the bonus right. on this podcast.
So that's what I'm trying to add into all my trout space streamers at this point are those five elements. And to me, that's what attracts the fish. And then you tie them in different colors to attract the fishermen, the anglers.
Right. Yeah. Well, I love the pushing the water.
Yeah.
When we were doing some of the steelhead stuff, what was it called? One of the guides that we were down there with used some of, I think it was Blaine Chocolate's tubing. I can't remember exactly what it, but he puts this, it's this tubing stuff. And they were putting this underneath the hackle, essentially. And I can't remember the name, but anyways, it worked. I mean, literally, he gave me one of those flies. I went out and caught a couple fish on it. So yeah, it's that pushing. It's like doing something different. So the fly isn't just laying down like a noodle in the water. You want it breathing, right?
Right. You want it breathing and pushing water. And, you know, I believe anyway that trout can sense that, probably using their lateral lines more than anything, that push of water underwater on the water surface really is attractive to them. And so, you know, if I'm putting in, say, for instance, a rabbit for a collar, I'll have something behind it that props that rabbit fur up just a bit so it doesn't sweep all the way back along the body of the fly and go ultra flat, which is kind of the idea of intruders, you know, the true intruder from back in the day was just to have it be a big presence, you know, having those fibers stick out quite a bit so it pushes water.
That's it. Right on. Right. And I think
fun stuff too. I mean, Dave, it's just like this whole world opens up and you start messing with the stuff and pulling ideas from saltwater, from salmon and steelhead and then downsizing it to trout. And, you know, it's really a whole nother series of flies that you can tie and fish.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And I just looking at it's I think it's called the body, Blaine's body tubing.
Body tubing,
I think a bunch of people fly them in. Lots of people have that stuff out there. So anyways, but cool. Well, we touched on the flies, so we got that. What else are we missing? I know we haven't hit deep, but if we go back to your presentation, as we start to think about taking this out of there, what else do you want to leave somebody with? If you think about, you know, okay, they got the rod, that's easy. Even the woolly, I love that you said the woolly bugger, because now they can just go and grab the woolly bugger. What else should they be thinking about before they get on the water?
Well, one of the things that can seem like, and it was for me, is like extremely overwhelming. When you go to, say, YouTube and you start looking at spey casting, particularly the two-handed stuff, you know, single-hand casting, most of them are doing like snap tees or maybe a snake roll here and there or just a single spey or a double spey. But even right there, that's a whole lot of different casts. And you go, well, why in the world are the casts that complicated? Moving all over the place. And when you start to break them down, it really isn't that complicated. And the reason you need them is mainly has to do with the way the current is flowing and which side of the river you're on. And probably most importantly, how the wind is blowing. And so let's talk about it as a roll cast. For people that don't really know spey casting, when you roll cast, you don't want to have that D loop that you form upwind of you, because when you make that forward cast, the wind is very likely to push your fly line down on top of you along with the hook. Okay. And so just think of that. It's the same thing with spey casts. You do not want to have that D loop that forms, kind of that abbreviated back cast, if you will. You don't want it on the upwind side. And so they're different casts. So no matter what side of the river you're on, which way the current is flowing, you can keep that D loop on the downwind side of you. This changes from river right to river left. And it gets kind of complicated, but in the end, you'll figure it out. And that's why there's so many casts. And then they're kind of different styles. They're waterborne casts, and which lend themselves to skagit lines, and then their touch and go casts, which are more scandy line oriented, very just a light touch on the water surface, and then it's gone. And so that's why all the different casts, it'll take you a while if you're just starting out to sort them all out, but it really isn't that difficult in the end. And that there is good reason for it. It isn't just people making up casts.
Yeah, exactly. The wind is a big part. Where do you think,
You know, obviously, like a fly shop would be a good place to go into, maybe get a lesson. What else do you recommend? If somebody wanted to dig in deeper on casting, is there something where they can kind of look at YouTube videos or another resource you'd recommend?
Yeah, YouTube is incredibly valuable. You know, there's some DVDs out. You can do that. But, you know, YouTube is, for the most part, free. And there are some great, fabulous instructors there. And I know I'm going to name a few or miss some here, but like Klaus Freemore, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, definitely. Klaus is awesome.
And he does these Scandicasts and really is not very fond of Skagit casting. And so he's fun to watch. Simon Gawsworth, of course, one of the best instructors ever, just clear and to the point. Oh my gosh, Topher Brown has got a few. Yeah, Topher's an amazing instructor. And John Hazlitt is another one. And again, I apologize for who I'm missing. I watched all these guys, but YouTube, tremendous resource for it. And they break it down. I mean, they'll go in depth on a snake roll, for example. And then, you know, talk about gear and spay cast. Regular fly casting is a very dynamic thing. And, you know, back in the day, I learned from books and magazines and little diagrams with candy cane loops and 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And so when you see it in, you know, full 4K, 120 frame per second, slow motion, you can really, really get the idea of what people are doing. And it's movement in three dimensions, not just two. You know, regular overhead casting, yes, that's three-dimensional, but not as three-dimensional as, say, a spay cast. And so you've got a whole bunch of stuff going on, and video, especially slow-motion video, is really beneficial to learning and to teaching.
Nice. So yeah, I'll put some links out to some of the people we talked about. I think Klaus we had on 127, and definitely Topher. Those are definitely all good connections.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, I think we did a good job kind of, you know, with a primer on this. We might have to circle back around with you at a later point and, you know, cover some more. And it is a lot. You know, you can go as deep as you want.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all good. It's all fun. You know, for me, it's pretty new. And I certainly wasn't bored with fly fishing. I don't want anybody to come away with that impression, but it's just like, it's this new thing that, you know, new life and new opportunities. And, you know, we incorporate it with some travel and, you know, then you're starting to find destinations that are suitable for trout spay.
I hear you. No, I've been, had a John Gearock book. I'm trying to think of the one, but man, that guy, he's so good at describing just what we're talking about, the traveling around and the stories. And he does spay, right? He does some steelhead fishing. He loves it. Even though he's a big trout guy, he's been bitten by it too. And it's not just steelhead, but I think it is just trying something new and, you know, another test, right? It's or not a test, but another challenge. You never want to get tired of stuff. So, well, and remind us again as we take it out of here. So your course, if somebody was to find this or look you up either online or at one of your events, what else are you going to cover there on these courses? Are you going to go deep into like just techniques and stuff like that and other pieces of the trout spay?
Yeah. What I'm doing now is I can teach the basics of spay casting, trout spay, but I will not go into detail on that. There are people who are much better versed at it than I am. So, you know, whether it's on the river or online or, you know, in person, it's much more kind of like we covered here. And I like to do a show and tell. In other words, what I bring on the river with me when I'm trout spay fishing, you know, what gear I bring, I try to keep it to a minimum. And what I look for, how I practice, things like that. That's what I'm bringing to the table in these presentations. In terms of spay casting, I'm still learning. And I'm not to the point yet where I want to teach somebody how to spay cast. I'm still taking lessons myself. In fact, I have, do you know who Whitney Gould is?
Yeah, she's the champion, right? The champion.
And so my wonderful wife, for Christmas, best Christmas present I think I've ever got, she has given me, when I'm out in California at the Pleasanton show, I have a lesson with Whitney at spay lesson at with Whitney at Golden Gate Casting
Club.
And so it's covering a multitude of things for me. I've been watching video from Golden Gate and reading stories for years, and I know Whitney from the shows, and it's one of these things where I'm really excited about it, but I'm also nervous at the same time. that I'm going to be casting at Golden Gate. And Whitney Gould is going to be critiquing my cast and hopefully helping me along.
That's amazing.
Yeah, always learning, you know, and that's a huge fun part of it for me.
How far is that? How far is the Golden Gate Casting Club from
Pleasanton?
Yeah. It's right there, right? San Francisco, right? It's just like an hour or so away.
Yeah, an hour. It's I think it's the San Mateo Bridge you have to get over, which across the bay,
yeah,
which can be a little hairy at rush hour. But we have an extra day, and I got a couple presentations out that way. In fact, a Trout's Bay presentation where, you know, I have video shows the setups that we were talking about, and pretty much everything we were talking about, and then I'll do a little show and tell at the end, I think people have found value in it so far. I've been doing it for a couple of years now.
Nice. Well, I think we're going to get this one is going to go live hopefully before the Pleasanton show. So maybe we'll give people a heads up that you're going to be there, and then people can connect with you there. Nice.
Super.
All right, Tim. Well, I think, let's take it out here. We got the 2-minute drill. I've been working on the 2-minute drill, trying to force us to wrap it up here. So I got a couple of little rapid fire questions for you. These will be easy.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's do this. I'm going to start the timer. Make sure we stick within the 2 minutes if we can. All right, here we go. So we've been talking rod. So we're talking single head, everything. You got one rod to pick. What is it for the rest of your days?
Single hand, 9'5" weight.
Gotcha. Okay. One fly. For the rest of time.
Oh gosh, I'm gonna go with the squirrel and hurl bugger. Terms of just productivity, all around, can't beat it.
Okay, and we've been talking spay today, trout spay. Give us one tip that would be something somebody could take away from today. It could be anything, casting or flies or anything that pops.
Gosh, the biggest one is to get coaching from an expert in terms of equipment, casting, everything. Benefit from their experience.
Yep. Perfect. And what's your one trip? So you've been doing some stuff. What if you had your one trip you can do that you haven't done yet? What do you want?
New Zealand, without a doubt.
There you go. New Zealand. Okay. And then, do you have a local fly? What's the closest fly shop to you? I don't know if you have a local shop there.
We do. And I guide through them. I do tying classes with them. It was, formerly called Shannon's Fly and Tackle. It's been in business since 1970. And unfortunately, one of the owners of Shannon's passed away this year at the ripe old age of 55. He's a very, very good friend and was just horrible all the way around. But the good news is that the fly shop has been taken over by a young couple. They purchased it, and they've kind of had a soft opening back in December. They will be open completely with guiding and everything like that. I'll be guiding with them starting about mid-April. They were unable to keep the name Shannon's, which is known, you know, kind of far and wide, and but just for legal and financial reasons, it's now South Branch Outfitters, and it looks to be a great shop, just as the old Shannon's was.
Perfect. All right, Tim. Well, we'll send everybody out to tightlinesproductions.com. Just want to thank you again for another great episode. We're excited to keep in touch with you here and everything else you have going. So, yeah, thanks again for all the time today.
Oh, well, thank you, Dave. That was fun.
So there it is, wetflyswing.com/430, 430. You can get some show notes, get some links, and I'm sure there's going to be a couple of Tim Flagler fly tying videos. You can get that view of his fly tying angle from the front side. Check it out right now. And also, you're going to see a link to the Stillwater School, wetflyswing.com/trips. Right now, we've got a few slots left. And if you're interested in heading up to a remote wilderness area to one of the coolest lodges you're going to find anywhere and a chance at some great big rainbows, this is the trip for you. We actually have early bird pricing still right now. This is $400 off this trip, and it's going to end, I think, in about 10 days. So this is your shot. The window is going to be closing. You can check it out right now. Okay, where are we heading next? Let's take a look. Let's take a quick peek and see where we are heading next.
Okay, this week we got some bonus episodes this week. Tomorrow we're heading out. We're going to hear from Choda, Choda Outdoor Gear. This is a good one, Caleb and Mark. This is a very fun episode. You don't want to miss that one tomorrow. Thursday, we got a big surprise. We got Brendan Morrison, NHL hockey player, and we hear his story. Also, Real West Coast host. Check that out. And then I got a really giant surprise for you on Friday. On Friday, the Great Lakes Dude is here. The Great Lakes Dude podcast finally is here. Jeff Liskey is going to be here to give us his intro on the very first podcast, a Great Lakes podcast. So you don't want to miss that. Jeff's going to give us a really cool intro to the Great Lakes. He is our man, and he is going to break it out on Friday this week. Very big week. I think we're getting very close to every day of the week. And we're going to keep working on it. Hope to connect with you, maybe see you on the water, maybe see you online. And I hope you are having a great evening, great morning, or a great afternoon, wherever in the world you are. And I appreciate you for checking in and stopping by today.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.